Demos,
I mean, those who reacted against the decisions of Dort. All those who moved against the decisions of Dort are called remonstrators.
And there's another question I have. I find the exact reference, but one over this. You mentioned, you're talking about reform, with a capital R and then in the same paragraph, a small r.
Probably just the fingers on the page. Whether it's when the term reform is used with a capital R, it's used to refer to the quality of truth propagated out of Calvin and Knox. Using a small r,
page 92 on your syllabus says mere convenient grace and sense of faith save no one.
That's right.
And that's the Catholic doctrine.
Well, that's anybody's doctrine.
Well,
that's anybody's doctrine.
So maybe I don't understand. And I think faith is just like intellectual knowledge of the
facts. That's right. The idea is that the common grace that everybody receives makes them feel bad, you know, when they're out fishing on Sunday. And the intellectual assent were not regarded in the scholastic period as being salvational, nor in the reform period. So somebody could look up and say, well, I believe Jesus is the Son of God, and I'm sorry that I hit my mother-in-law last night. But that would not be proof of salvation. I don't know why I have such a happy relationship with my in-laws that I'm not even sure why that illustration comes to me. I've had a very happy relationship with my in-laws, my mother-in-law, and father, twice as good to me as my own mother. We have had a very, very happy relationship. And I have a happy relationship with my own mother, too. And my family is essentially a family of erratics and eccentrics. I'm by far the most normal of them all. And my normality is not known to you all, because all you see me in this professorial style that has come along with the latter years and with greater feeling of importance, living up to a good image and all that sort of thing. But my wife was home last weekend visiting her mother for her birthday and whatnot, and came back Sunday night, was telling me of a circumstance which was typical of our family. One of my nephews is in the military down in Texas, and he married a girl from Houston. And so on his first leave, he's a fine young Christian fellow, just a dandy guy. But he brought his bride home, of course, on the first leave to meet his parents and all that kind of stuff. And, of course, you would have to make a run of all of the families to see who was all there and all that sort of thing. So she went to my sister's house. They went to my sister's house for dinner one night. One of my sisters had prepared a very elaborate meal, as is their custom, but had hidden it in the oven. And on the table had only a bowl of cold sauerkraut, mustard, ketchup, mayonnaise, and plates, of course. Her children were all primed for the act, because they're all a bunch of eccentrics. So they all sat down at the table and gave thanks and began passing this cold sauerkraut. And my nephew looked stunned, and his bride was trying to say, "My, sauerkraut, she was really fond of it." At least held it till everyone had been served and began to eat their cold sauerkraut. Then my sister descended to the basement kitchen and produced a meal, all that sort of thing. But the following day, when he took the girl to a reception in their church, a very Bible Baptist church, he took the girl to a reception of the church. Of course, my family was coming, or a good many of them coming. And my brother Ernest showed up. Ernest was the chicken king. My brother Ernest showed up wearing an 18th century coat with striped soccer stockings, which his pants were tucked, and a phony wig and a bunch of other things. The whole family showed up looking like freaks. It's an exciting group, and I am by far the most normal of the lot. And my normalcy has come feeling that you ought to in some ways attain a certain dignity as you grow. But in college, in college in Dayton, Tennessee, where, among other things, I gave the entertainments to all the basketball games between halftime and stuff like that, my most notable prank of my first year in college probably was walking through Dayton, Tennessee in a suit and a tie, and it was pouring Tennessee rains with an umbrella that had no cloth on it. And it certainly establishes a reputation for you. May or may not. Smart aleck, show off, stupid, donkey, anything, but it establishes reputation for you. And in our family, the motto was, it is better to be known and to be ill thought of than to be well thought of and ignored. Worked with that for a while. Now, I was talking with you about the Reformation before we took this break and we got carried away with family annals. Everybody's life is interesting to him. It's just dull to the people that have to listen to it, that's all. So sometime maybe he'll be a teacher and you can tell about all your crazy relatives and all the interesting things that happen to you, as the case might be. I don't really know. But I was talking about the Reformation, about the anthropology type things. I don't like to overplay it or underplay it, either one. It was one of the big anthropology and soteriology were the big issues in the Reformation period, and the fathers worked on them very hard, the Reformation fathers. Calvin, Luther, prone to see man, is totally subject to grace. They were all big on grace. The debates that came later after Calvin was gone, the Arminian debates that came after Calvin was gone, have successfully divided the Calvinistic camp. I have lengthy notes on him in the syllabus. Arminius himself was a pretty strong Calvinist, James Jacobus Arminius. His works are in print today in three volumes. Arminius himself was a Dutch Reform man, professor in the university, but he rebelled against the doctrine that is known as double predestination, or in theology, superlapsarianism. Now, all of the views on these subjects are hotly argued over today. This fellow believes this thing, and that fellow believes something else. And again, I plead with you that sometimes it's not so much a matter of what you believe as how you believe it and how you stand on it. You can believe a perfect truth, but stand on it in an obnoxious and nasty way. But Arminius himself was a Calvinist of no mean stripe.
Can you delineate what exactly you mean by double predestination?
Well, that's the problem you run into in historical theology, these high-flown terms. But there are three views on election, or at least three. There might be 20, but there are at least three. Double predestination is the idea that men are equally either predestined for heaven or predestined for hell. A single predestination or single election is the idea that some men are elect for heaven. The others make the choice that they want and choose the wages of sin. But that there has been, that's known as infralapsarianism in theology. And then there's a view called sublapsarianism, which means everything is up for grabs. And God has very little to do with it, and you have everything. That's a popular view in many circles. Because today our theologians are much more interested in making man freer than God is. So double predestination is the idea that all men are equally either appointed to hell or to heaven. It's called superlapsarianism. And just as you can say the believer is elect in Christ, you can say the unbeliever is elect to hell.
Certain people have been selected by God, like Jeremiah or something like that, and others are non-washed masses, they just said they've been decided themselves.
Bypassed, they would say. They would say that some are elect, and that the rest are bypassed. It's a complicated thing, but which Dunswater will run you through 42 Greek words and several Hebrew expressions. But Arminius objected to that, the superlapsarian view. You'll discover that the theology of Arminius is far too Calvinistic for most Arminians. He objected to that, though. He objected to what we call irresistible grace, or what is called irresistible grace. He objected to that. He said a man could resist grace.
Consequently, election was not absolute to Arminius. Election was conditioned on the response of the individual.
The doctrine of irresistible progress.
Well, I think the exact wording comes more from the Synod of Dort, but the idea is Augustine's. And there may have been somebody before him. The idea is Augustine's. A beautiful picture of him in literature is Francis Thompson's poem, The Hound of Heaven. If you've got an opportunity to read poetry, you'd like to read that kind of stuff. Read out loud, in fact, it's homiletics. But the Dutch split over the teachings of Arminius, who died peacefully before it came to... He died peacefully. 9 years later, the Synod of Dort would decide against him. A lot of his followers would be shot. I'm always emotional there, see. I wish it's one thing to disagree with the brethren, but it's an awful thing when we're disagreeing over, we conclude the other side has to be annihilated. I've always been fearful I'd be on the side that got annihilated, I guess, but I've always thought it was a poor way to look at it. Arminius's big interpreter was a fellow called Episcopius, whose name you don't need to worry about here. It'll show up somewhere later in another course. But he reinterpreted Arminius, made him much broader than he actually was. Arminius felt that maybe what we call security, he felt that maybe the saints were secure and maybe they weren't. He thought it was an open question. But Episcopius made the concept of salvation a matter of living on top of that basic profession. And Episcopius is really the father of the type of theology that John Wesley would later propound. I have viewed the whole thing as an unfortunate argument, and I've looked at it and said these men were trying to do with God's will and God's decrees what Apollinaris and Nestorius were trying to do with Christ's person. They were trying to run it back to an indefinable point. And consequently, they succeeded in alienating one another and causing a great amount of strife, physical strife, as well as spiritual and emotional strife. I'd like to stop with the happy maxim of saying that when you're born again, you can speak of election with great authority. And at the same time, you can talk about preaching the gospel to every creature. I'd just like to stop at that. I'd like to not have to work out all the details behind it. That's known as the coward's approach. But that's where I'd like to stop. And if they had been willing to stop there, I would have saved them a lot of grief. They couldn't, of course. You can't really. It's like a snowball in an avalanche. You can't really stop. And you can't always see where you're going, because I'm sure things I've pursued in my day, and somebody 10 years later would have said, why in the world would they make an issue of that? So at the time, everything is emotive. But anthropology, if nothing else in the Reformation period, if nothing else, produced a great sense of the reality of grace in all schools. And that was its chief function. You'll discover that there are very few men who are pure in any of these theological brackets today. Now, I wanted to pause right there. If I had my pen, I'd make a little insert right there. I wanted to pause right there. And I wanted to mention to you that out of those discussions, and out of the total picture, really, but out of them grow a lot of what we call schools of theology. I was mentioning this with Thompson between the classes in a crude way. There grow a lot of schools of theology out of that thing. Now there grows the Lutheran school. And there grows the Calvinistic school. And there grows the Arminian school. And there grows the Anabaptist school. And eventually, because it's a heresy, you'll have a Socinian school, but it will affect all of those very much. It will have its own effect on those. And there are two or three others, too. These are the major schools that you'll run into, and of course there's a Roman Catholic school behind them all. So you develop whole schools of theology, which before the Reformation you really didn't have. Before the Reformation was hardly standardized or streamlined. You'll develop whole schools of theology after the Reformation. because, of course, they split the seamless road, and it allowed every group to continue the true church as it saw fit. After a while, in this camp, you will see very much the development of formal theological schools. The ones that are closest to us today are the schools called dispensationalism and covenant theology. Dispensationalism and covenant theology rise from the same tree. And if the men who hold them would stop throwing stones, they would see what Warfield saw years ago, that in many points they are frightfully alike. Some points they are quite different. But they rise out of the same tree. I, again, have always had a mediatorial rule. I've tried it many times, somebody said, well, what are we talking about? What do you mean by that term? And sometimes when you get through the semantics, you discover, but they rise out of that same tree. But you have a school there, 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 and they are all quite distinct. Now they all have some points in common. In the Reformation, all of these schools had in common their attitude towards the Word of God and their understanding of ecclesiology. Their understanding of Christology and theology proper. They all had those things in common in the days of the Reformation. They have branched off somewhat since, especially with the inroads of liberalism in the last many years. But they were all quite distinct in their own right, quite distinct. The difference between Anabaptists and Arminians is quite pronounced in several areas, but they have some things in common. They both tended to think that salvation was never a finished process in this life. They both tended to think that. But Anabaptists, on the whole, were pacifistic, and Arminians, on the whole, kept their swords sharp and used them well. It's a tricky thing. They have some things in common, some things in which they greatly disagreed. The Anabaptist view on the priesthood was almost identical with Calvin's. Almost identical. Not with the Lutheran, however, but almost identical with Calvin. That's the concept, of course, that every believer is a priest and that the preacher in a group is simply one of the boys. He's a first in a circle of friends. Their view on the ministry was almost identical in the earlier days. Well, as time goes on, all these schools will bridge out and develop into other things. After a while, you'll get Anabaptists that are Calvinistic. You'll get Anabaptists that are Arminian. You'll get some that are Lutheran. After a while, you'll get Calvinists that are Socinian, which is a contradiction in terms, but you will actually get it. You'll get a whole school in New England, the Hopkinsian theology. You'll get a whole school of Socinian Calvinists, which is a contradiction in terms, but you will get it. So as time goes on, the picture in historical theology gets enormously muddled. And then, as I will mention in a few moments, you have a whole new creedal age. Because as the issues get muddled, the need for clear statements greatly increases. Well, let me leave that and return to my chart. Mrs. Stewart.
Well, all Baptists are of the Anabaptist family. The Anabaptist family did not start with the Reformation any more than the Calvinist family did. There are aspects of them scattered throughout the whole history. All Baptists are part of the Anabaptist family. It's a big family. Anabaptist means baptize again is what it means, baptize again. And you will find representatives of them in every age. But Anabaptists, it's an honorable term. I had a friend, though, who I've had a lot of friends that I kept for a few weeks. And he pointed out to me, he said, our folks, he was a very solid Anabaptist voter. He said, our folks never persecuted anybody. I said, well, you never had the chance. I said, you were never a majority party. But I said, in the one place in history where you were a majority party, I said, you persecuted fiercely. Well, he said, they weren't really Anabaptists. He said, they were, that's what we call in church history, the Munster Confederacy. And he said, well, they weren't really Anabaptists. He said, they were pretenders. Well, I said, that's the one time in history when you were the majority party, pretenders or not, I said. And, of course, two or three of the leaders had been outstanding teachers before the Munster Confederacy was formed. So, I cheerfully look around and say, my group has never persecuted anybody. There have never been enough of us to stamp on a flea, hardly. But I hate to think what might happen if you're given a chance, because power corrupts people quickly. A theological student should, in the course of seminary, about four times read The Lord of the Rings, in addition to reading the Bible 50 or 60 times. But they should read The Lord of the Rings from the secular point of view to get the feeling of what power does to even very nice people. It tends to corrupt very, very quickly. And it's always easy to say, I've never done anybody any harm, but you've always been under their foot. But if you've got the big shoe for once, maybe under your foot, better off. Now, as far as the Reformation is concerned, I can leave those schools for a moment and mention Christology. Really, very little done in Christology. So let me say a word about soteriology. I do appreciate that. Yeah, very little done in Christology, so let me say a word about soteriology. Oh, yes. You ought to know that for the final. The Reformation produced nothing new in soteriology of a healthy sort. They produced a couple heresies. But by and large, they re-emphasized the Anselmian idea. Anselm became the hero of the Reformers in soteriology. And the Reformers took a vicarious view of the atonement, almost right down the line. You do have a couple heretical groups. You have the governmental school start for a while. You have a moral influence school for a bit. They are pronounced heresies. The moral influence school has a funny way of sneaking back in. You remember what that is? The moral influence school was the idea that Christ in his death on the cross provided an example of expiation of sin. And what he did there influenced society for the betterment. So that God doing something as great as that influences us to do good things for one another too. So in the moral influence field, the atonement is really a matter of persuasion, moral suasion. And that shows up in strange places. Years later, it will show up in the theology of Charles Finney. And years later, in the Oberlin theology in this country. Of course, it plays on. Moral influence theology usually goes liberal in one generation. Most others take at least two. But it usually goes liberal in about one generation. And in this country, you will meet it in the Oberlin theology later on under men like Horace Bushnell. Finney the Evangelist was touched by it. But Finney the Evangelist went through a long career. See, Finney was a Presbyterian evangelist who went through a long career, and with each crusade found it necessary to change some of his theological applications to meet the situation. Never really systematized. His lectures on evangelism, his lectures on theology, present a very keen mind, badly desystematized. Badly desystematized. He was a converted lawyer, Presbyterian preacher, then he was. But badly desystematized. Theology was not his forte. And like many other evangelists, if he had stayed out of it, the whole church would have been better off. But because he had to write a book on it and start a school to perpetuate his ideas, hardly any place in the world that the liberalism is more keenly evidenced than the Oberlin School of Theology. It lasted about half of a generation. And Oberlin today is better known for its music departments, of course. It's amazing how we can make these pronouncements in the sanctitude of the Biblical School of Theology and all these other institutions scattered around the world. But it represents a course in history. So the vicarious atonement was championed. Ecclesiology saw the overthrow of the seamless robe idea. The governmental school of theology was the idea that God governed the atonement. That God was the governor of the world, and to satisfy his justice, there had to be some payment for sin. Now, that's you can hardly find fault with that. But Christ only died, not for you. He died to meet the requirement of the government of God. You are just incidental to the whole occasion. So the government of God called for the payment of an ultimate sacrifice, which really was not for you in a personal sense, but because the government said, if you sell wheat, you got to collect so much per bushel, and this is it. The governmental theory, on the whole, is more palatable than the moral influence theory. And Mrs. Stewart. I don't think so. Aquinas pretty much followed Anselm on the atonement. Pretty much.
I use in church history the text by Walker, the one volume text by Wilson Walker. And Walker, of course, is a liberal from Yale, but I don't like him. And 99% of his book is very edifying. When he's discussing the theories of the atonement, the Reformation, he says something which is as telling as anything I've ever read. He talks about Grotius' view, Socinus' view, and then he comes after that and says, somehow, he said, all of these views of the atonement, he said, are less than adequate. He said, somehow, he said, any view of the atonement must take into account that Christ died for us. He says it with great emphasis. And it sounds frightfully evangelical at that point, and you kind of wish that it might be so in the hearts of all those who say those things. But he has his finger on the truth, and that is that eventually all the views of the atonement that overlook the personal involvement of the believer in the death of Christ fail. It's the only view somehow satisfies the church and the scripture.
They fail pragmatically and philosophically also. Now, in ecclesiology, the Reformation contributed the idea that the church is not an institutional one. It's not an organization, but an organism.
And consequently, there is no obligation to the institution. St. Luther never meant it that way. And Calvin really didn't mean it that way either. Because in Germany, where Luther was, you could either be a Roman Catholic or a Lutheran, but you couldn't be anything else. The concept of freedom of religion, as we understand it, was as far from Luther's mind as jumping off the Empire State Building with an umbrella for a parachute. You could either be this, a true, honest believer, or they could tolerate a few Catholics, but they didn't know what to do about it. But Calvinists and Anabaptists in Lutheran countries had a tough time of it. And in Geneva, Calvin recognized the validity of Luther's teaching in much of its parts. He thought he was awfully superficial in a lot of his illustrations and didn't know when to put the punchline in his jokes. But in much of his parts, he felt that Luther's teaching was good. But in Geneva, there was room for one church, just one. That was, of course, there were many churches, but one theological group, and that was the group of which Calvin and Farrell were the nominal teachers. He didn't pick up a phone directory, it's the directory of churches. Now, that view perpetuated, dominated the ancient world. That view was really broken in this country, ultimately. But the idea that the seamless robe was not an organization, but an organism, the idea was in all the fathers. They just didn't realize where it would go. So Calvin said, we haven't split the church, we continue the church. Luther eventually said the same thing. Zwingli was more blunt. He did not live long enough to make a great contribution. But he always wished Zwingli had lived another 20 years. For better or for worse, it's hard to know how it would have gone. But Zwingli was very blunt. Zwingli said nonsense to the whole thing. He could do what he wanted to. But Calvin argued for the perpetuation of the church. Luther did also. So did Menno Simon. Zwingli said, oh, knock it off, Paulus. We're just done with that. He was very, very blunt and adamant. And of course, spent too much time swinging the sword. The commentators, everybody who writes the life of Zwingli goes back to the Lord's remark, he that lives by the sword will die from the sword. And that, of course, is how he died. And he died rather soon, so it's hard to know where he would have gone in the course of time. But in ecclesiology, they demonstrated that the organizational institution was not the church. And the demonstration of that truth would soon allow for a proliferation of churches, most of which claim to be the true one. I was down in Carolina preaching a couple years ago near Raleigh. I stayed in the house of a farmer out in the country where I just had the finest possible kind of time. A quiet fellow who in the Carolinian tradition said very, very little, ever. And when he did say it, it took him a long time to say it. A long time to say it. There's some of them talk like machine guns, too. It took him a long time to say it. We were sitting there eating breakfast Monday morning after the Sunday service, reading breakfast before I left for the day, that's it. And he said to me, he said, you will observe a lot of strange things around here. Because he said, you will see my wife has died. camels. Long pause.
Three sips of coffee. Two or three forks full of grits.
A couple pieces of well-burned bacon.
They can go weeks at a time. No water.
Think about that for a while. I didn't know whether to laugh or not to laugh. But anyhow, down the road from his farm were three churches.
They kind of, one of them he'd given the property to, and the other one he'd given the building to. After he said it was just a dump anyway, he said, they might as well have it. So he'd given them the building and the other one the property. Fine man. The first church, let's not get into names on it. The first church had an interesting sign. The second church had the most interesting sign of all. It gave the name of the church underneath it, the little thing upon it said, where truth makes the difference. And the third church had a church proclaiming itself to be the only church. So there within the space of a mile were three churches, one in which truth made a difference, the other one being the only true church, and the first one naturally doesn't get the first shot, but the first one being the fundamental and basic church community. And I drove along and said, this is the fruit of the Reformation. Well, it's really not the fruit of the Reformation, it's the fruit of wickedness. But when the Reformation demonstrated, and I guess we're all glad for it, I'm kind of glad for it, that the church is not an organizational oneness, but a living kind of thing. But I'm sure that if Calvin had foreseen about 400 Protestant-type denominations, a third of which claimed they were loyal to him, he'd probably walked up to Sadlet and shaken his hands and said, well, Cardinal, where do you want me to preach? I don't think he would have done that. But I'm sure he had no idea where it would go. No idea. The Reformation made three giant contributions. In addition to what little help it gave to theology and the re-emphasis, it made three giant contributions. One of those, see, they're not really historic propositions, but they're three giant contributions. One of them was the teaching that everybody should read and have the Bible for himself. One was on the teaching that everybody should read. Luther is the father of the modern idea that everybody should read. He's the father of the modern school movement, especially as it's practiced in this country of all places. He's the father of the idea that everybody should read. Because to him and Calvin, if you couldn't read, you couldn't study the scriptures, and that was how you could be saved. So they pushed it.
In my readings, I couldn't find any reasons why the Roman Catholic Church group. All right, it wasn't Roman Catholic until after the Reformation, but why the church proper and later the Roman Catholic were rolled back to the Bible?
They felt that only the church could interpret the traditions that came with it, and you didn't stand a chance if you were a shoemaker, for example. How would you know what Augustine said or any of these men? Well, they felt that only the body politic could interpret its doctrines. And of course, today the church has relented on that, but for about 400 years they followed the edict of the Trent that the Bible could not be printed in the vernacular. They held that for a long time. Long time, until history forced them out, but they held it for a long, long time. But the Reformers argued, boy, and consequently there were Bibles printed by the ton. They were around the world before you knew it. Bible printing became big business. The second contribution was the concept of the priesthood of the believer. That there is no formal priestly concept following the Old Testament pattern. But in this new age, every believer is a priest. Hence, he needs no confessor.
Oh, it's good if he wants to confess his sins to another man. Because James tells us that it's good, say, if he wants to admit his sins to his wife. She'll remind him several of them in that few days anyway. It's good, but he doesn't need it. He doesn't need him. He's his own priest before God.
And the third big contribution was the emphasis on justification by faith alone. The emphasis that it isn't the sacraments that bring you grace,
or the offices of the church. Although all the Reformers were very big on the sacraments, very big on them. Luther is very sacramental, but he knows that it doesn't bring you grace. Justification is by faith alone, not by going to services. Even my services, said Luther. Mr. Christian.
Since Luther was so totally immersed in the Catholic justification by faith. Why would he so smattered by this glorified?
About what?
Why is he so smattered by this glorified?
Well, I suppose it's because personalities are rarely consistent. Rarely consistent. I really can't answer it, but the inconsistency of personalities. It's like a young woman I knew whose father had been a famous missionary and a fine man. I said, my, what a privilege to grow up in a home like that. Yeah, she said it took me 50 years to get over it. She said the man who was so gentle and patient with the pagans, she said, was a tyrant at home. And Luther suffered from personality inconsistency. That's probably half about it. Mr. Upton.
You said that Luther did not say the sacrament gave you grace.
That's right.
Didn't give him any kind of grace, not just saving grace.
No, saving grace.
Okay.
Yeah, saving grace. The sacraments enriched your salvation experience in Lutheran theology and gave you a kind of a living grace, but not a saving grace. I'll be back here on Thursday, Lord willing. Well, we're rapidly coming to the end of the interim. Perhaps you're aware of that by now. All good things stop sooner or later. And that's kind of the way it goes with the interim. It runs out also. This is the 12th meeting of the class in historical theology. And here's what I propose to take up today. In this ready form. I propose to take it up more or less in connection with all the other things you're doing. As the interim expires, I always find it good to remind students that the Kelly should be completed probably about tomorrow evening. For the sake of integrity, I think the exam is Tuesday. Is that the exam? I think the exam is Tuesday. Tuesday is a terminus ad quem. That means that there ain't no tomorrow beyond Tuesday. It's the end of the whole thing, see? There's no such thing as a complete in the interim. It's just incomplete. It's just over, that's all. And it's over before you know it. So if you have not been up to date on my reading schedule in Kelly, or if you did not read and play during the Christmas vacation, I ask for a reading. I don't ask for a mastery. And as I told several students, that reading could be done anytime before Tuesday. But the chap who shows up on Tuesday and says, you know, I've only got 100 pages more to go, I just hate to tell you, but he has not read the book. That's all. It's fairly simple. So as long as we have an understanding on that, then we can be happy. Don't call me Thomas the Soft for nothing. But don't test me on it. If it isn't finished by Tuesday, you just haven't read it. That's one of the great, great facts of life. And I hate to say it in an argumentative and nasty way like that, but I know exactly how it comes. I was a student. I still am a student. I know many of the weaknesses and many of the problems. I remember sitting up all night more than once to complete a paper due the next day because I didn't have the courage to face old what's-his-name and tell him that I didn't do it or hadn't have it done. And I don't think I ever had to say I'm not done. But boy, two or three times I worked 72 hours in a row to get it done. And the quality, of course, was apparent from that kind of work. And I usually had instructors who could recognize that kind of quality and grade it for what it was worth. Sometimes not very flattering. I remember my research and a research paper I had to write for English Lit in the second or third year of college. I didn't know what that research paper is. I regard them as one of the great abominations of all time. And so I finally took a metallurgical cast of my research paper and wrote a giant one on the rivets in the Eiffel Tower, including the number of counts of them and the various shapes of them, with original demonstrations of how rivets that are smashed too flat in the end corrupt and corrode. I got a D for it, naturally, although it went to 22 pages and had considerable research in it. But the D was passing. And I can only tell you that I'm not proud of those things today, but I'm kind of amused by them yet. And when I see my children, I see my son walking in with a paper written on Abraham Lincoln, written on a paper that previously held potato chips the night before, so it's so greasy your fingers slide, I know where he is. I know exactly where he is, and if the Lord tarries and gives grace, I know where he'll probably be in 20 or 25 years, and where his children will be. That's the way it goes. So in historical theology, we've talked about the development of the statements of the doctrine. I've tried to repeatedly stress, that we think the doctrines do not develop, that the doctrines are emphatic in the Scripture. We think that what develops is our understanding of them, and consequently our expression of them. and hence each age may have to find certain expressions of its own, although in the framework of historical theology, we generally built on what has been subscribed and given by the preceding ages. You will read whole books on the development of doctrine. In Catholic circles, development of doctrine usually means the way in which the tradition of the church has come to understand the doctrine, and it actually does mean development. In Catholic circles, development actually generally does mean development. They think that the doctrines are not fixed, that they grow with the tradition of the church and with the further revelation that is given through the papal offices and so forth. Most Protestant circles, we do not feel that way. We feel that if you could get off on a distant point and stand back and look at the Bible and the whole thing would be open flat before you at one time, you could see the whole thing in one glance and not have historic problems of your own, we think you could see every doctrine fully developed there and see exactly what it's supposed to be. But because you can't do that, you can't get off like that, like what's his name, you can't find a place where you can build the levers to move the world, you can't get off to a point like that. You consequently are always studying with greater detail at one level and another, and you never see the total picture of things. You never see the total picture. Hence, our statements change. And I kind of feel sorry for the fellow who says, well, I've never changed my opinion about a single teaching. I rather feel sorry for him. It usually indicates that his opinion is either not yet fixed, or he has one of those box-type minds where he gets an idea and locks it in, and he will always be somewhat immature from it. On the other hand, a person who changes his opinion every day leaves a little to be desired, too. So in between those two, we say that doctrinal statements develop, our grip on it develops. I tried to sketch that in the pre-Nicene period, the great emphasis was on theology proper. In the conciliar period, the great emphasis was on Christology. In the scholastic period, in the Reformation period, the great emphasis is on soteriology and anthropology. And I tried to stress as we went along kind of why that was. Throughout the whole period, there's a great teaching, great stress on ecclesiology, because that's where you live and work. And if you counted up all the pronouncements of the councils, all the books of the fathers, you would find that the writings on polity, practices in the church, outweigh the others about a ton to an ounce. That has been less true since the Reformation, because of a little hitch that I will discuss on about 2 points. As far as the Reformation is concerned, I mentioned that it's an exciting age, but it does not produce a lot of new things in doctrine. It does does work along certain new emphases, the sola scriptura emphases and so forth, and I mentioned that it makes major contributions in our understanding of priesthood, justification by faith, and the concept of interpreting the Bible by itself and things like that. It largely goes back and ratifies the doctrines confirmed by the church in its earlier stages. The Reformation is not an innovative period. It's largely a period of re-expression of the fundamental doctrines pronounced earlier. Its innovative areas are in ecclesiology. And I stressed the other day that the Reformation provided the grounds for, well, I don't know how I want to say it. The Reformation demonstrated that the seamless road of philosophy was really not in an organistic sense, in an organizational sense. It was really not a bona fide philosophy. Now, in a spiritual sense, the seamless robe ideal may still be right in that sense. But in an organizational sense, the Reformation proved that the seamless robe philosophy was not right. And the result was that it set the groundwork for the proliferation of churches, which we know in our day and age.
Are there any of it in the Bible that the seamless road is supposed to take an allegorical sense?
No, not a bit. Not a bit. Not a bit. The evidence in the Bible that anything is to be taken in an allegorical sense is slim. There is some. And there are some allegories. But the seamless road was just kind of a beautiful picture when you think about it. In an allegorical sense, and if you carry it over to John 17 and so forth. But there's no indication in Scripture at all that it should be seen like that. In fact, apart from the crucifixion scenes, it's never mentioned that. You don't have any record of it being sent down to Rome so a fisherman could wear it.
Is it supposed to be something miraculous or unusual, or is it just a passing mention?
Well, they build it, you know, after, I don't know how common
gowns, with, how common things without seams were in the ancient world. I don't know. They are not common in this world. I attempted once to make a sleeveless sweater without a seam. I was ill for a long time. I did a lot of knitting. It was therapeutic, and it kept you from thinking about the padding on the walls. You know, that's not really literal, but there's an aspect of truth in it. And I attempted with these round knitting needles to make a sleeveless sweater that had no seams in it. Sleeveless, sleeve, I don't know. I'm sure there are knitting people who could do that, too. It's not easy to do. It's not common. The more normal way to produce anything is to produce two or three pieces and sew them together real quick, like, one way or another. So the garment that Christ wore, being seamless, whether that made it absolutely, you know, without us, whether it made it absolutely unique or not, I don't know, but it certainly made it unusual, shall we say. Unique can usually indicate one of a kind. Certainly made it unusual. It certainly was not the normal thing. It implied something that was woven. And woven, you know, you can't cut it out of an animal skin unless you make the hands and legs fit the... It implied something that was woven. A man in New Jersey, I have to be careful, I feel just very talkative today. A man in New Jersey had a very fancy watering pot, which he had made out of one piece of copper without seaming or welding, constant beating, pounding. He was a metallurgist with Camden copper and all that kind of stuff. I never could believe that it was seamless, but it actually was. And he said to me, he said, I tried it 100 times and ruined 99 sheets of copper. Well, of course, that is as far as his project was concerned. Finally, when he got it done, he said, 100 people have asked me if I'd make another one. But he said, the answer is always no. That was what he would do. Well, and the picture of the seamless robe suggests something very unusual, and so it easily suggested the church, allegorically, that which was one, without bind, and so forth. But the Reformation innovations were in ecclesiology. And as I said a moment ago and said Tuesday, it set the groundwork for the proliferation of churches. Although there were several organizational differences before the Reformation, don't be deceived about that. There was the East-West Division. There were a number of smaller divisions within Rome itself. But it really set the groundwork for that. Now, I wanted to say a couple words about what I refer to as the Reformation symbols, because in historical theology, they come to be very interesting. I have some complicated thinking here, which I have written out in black and white pen and ink on these papers. But I don't want to just read it. I want to walk around and lament about it. So try to lament with me, and you might be happy. You remember that in the conciliar period, the idea was the whole church could meet and pronounce a doctrine. They could solve one problem, the whole church could meet. Luther believed that in the days of the Reformation. Luther believed, at least till 1519, Luther believed that there could be a general council of the whole church. Problems in the Roman church could be resolved. Well, he certainly believed that up to 1570, apparently believed until about 1519. That is neither here nor there today. But up till 1517, he kept calling for a pope to call a council of the whole church. Popes were afraid to, for a number of reasons that are part of another course. The Pope would not do it. Eventually the Pope will call a council, but he won't do it until the Reformation has been in full swing and too late for it to do anything. Luther believed that a council could really resolve matters. The idea of conciliar thinking is that if we get a group of believers, the whole council idea was if we get the whole group of believers together, they could produce a statement which would define a doctrine of the church to respond to. But it was demonstrated in Luther's time that the Roman Church wouldn't do it. And then when the Roman Church did meet, after 1545 at the Council of Trent, in three long sessions over about 20 years, when they did meet, it was obvious that they would not handle the Protestant issues nor give them a hearing. So it became obvious in the Reformation that the conciliar idea for the whole Church was lost. Period. However, each group then took that idea and brought it to itself. The idea being that if the whole church can't meet, then all of us who live in Hatfield could meet. And we could frame out a doctrinal statement. We would call it the Hatfield Amalgamated Confession. We would hammer out a statement or confession of belief. And then that belief would define us. And then when we went out to California, and we're in the heart of the slum district, we could pull out our statement of belief and see if there's anybody there who subscribed to it. We could have it. So the idea was that we would get a statement of belief which would describe not the total church, but would describe us, since it is no longer possible for the total church to meet and come to some kind of agreement. So it was that just about every group out of the Reformation period began the process of developing what we call a symbol, a dogmatic statement that identified them and their beliefs. The term symbol in theology means the creed or the statement that identifies a group. Theological symbol is not a duck sitting on a fence, but rather a statement which defines belief or identifies a group. And as the Reformation laid the groundwork for the proliferation of church bodies, it consequently laid the groundwork for the development of a wide bracket of symbols, identifying statements. So the great number of creeds that are available to us for research and study in historical theology today, the great number of them, 90% of them, are post-Reformation. You can count the creeds before the Reformation that were truly creedal. You can count them on the fingers of one hand, and you might need a toe or two, depending on how many fingers you have. Every council will produce its idea of the concept, but the great creeds, when you go beyond you go beyond Nicaea and Constantinople and Chalcedon, and you go beyond those, then you begin immediately picking up lesser creeds. You will find unofficial things like the Apostles' Creed, highly unofficial. But you will not find great creedal statements identifying bodies very much before the Reformation. You'll find lots of canonical laws, like why we worship you on Sunday, why the bishops of such and such a town should not go over to such and such a town. You'll find lots of stuff like that. But relatively little that is creedal. No, they usually started out endorsing the Nicene Creed, the Chalcedonian Creed, the Constantinople Creed. They usually started out by saying, we endorse the creeds in the ancient church, or, you know, words like that. So they usually were built on that. And that's why I said, or tried to say, that the Reformation largely was a re-emphasis on historic doctrines. They usually began.
They certain points.
They added 100 other things to them. They hardly refine anything in those basics. They added a lot of stuff to them. That's what they did. Mr. Gross.
How did the church see the ancient creed by the time today, like an earlier step to go?
No. You mean the Catholic Church or the Church of Modern? The Roman Church is prone to think of the ancient creeds as foundational. And you can say without batting an eyelash that Nicaea, Chalcedon, and Constantinople are looked at as foundational by all bodies of Christianity. Now, Chalcedon, you have to bite your tongue twice. The Monophysites would not look at it. But apart from the Monophysites, Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholics, Russian Orthodox, Protestants will look at Chalcedon, Nicaea, and Constantinople as being foundational to evangelical theology, church theology. The Roman Church, of course, came to the Roman Church never took anything from those three creeds. But the Roman Church, for this view of ongoing revelation and ecclesiastical tradition, added a lot of things, not to the creeds, but in other areas of life. So if you'd lined up a Catholic priest who was Orthodox and a Protestant theologian who was Orthodox and a Greek theologian who was Orthodox and asked all three of them what they thought about the first three creeds, you would get almost identical answers. Except as long as they told you what they thought about the creeds. If the Protestant told you why the Pope wasn't at the councils, then you might get a different answer. But on the creedal things, they would almost line up together. But the Reformation, producing different groups, not even the General Council, each one begins to produce its own. So today, a great amount of the study in historical theology is the study of Reformation and post-Reformation creeds, which we call symbols. I mentioned the major symbols after page 104 in my notes. I'm not going to say much about them here. I brought with me my own copy of the Westminster Confession, which is the standard symbolism in the Reformed bodies in this country. The Reformed theologians were great for producing confessions, perhaps greater than anybody else, because they divided more than others did. I don't know if that makes sense or not. But the Lutherans produced largely two giant confessions, the Augsburg Confession, and the Formula of Concord, as I mentioned in my notes. You later will have different Lutheran synods producing their own varieties of those confessions. But today you have the United Lutheran Church, which involves the vast majority of Lutheran bodies in this country, and their agreement is on the Formula of Concord, much more so than on the Augsburg Confession. They all kind of held it over the period of time. The church where I was converted accepted the Westminster Confession of Faith with a little rider that it added of its own. It accepted the Westminster Confession and the longer and shorter catechisms. And as a young man, I was 18 and I was converted, so whatever age that is, why, before you could join the church, even though you were converted about eight ways, before you could join the church as a convert, they required you for memorization of certain amounts of the confession and the larger and shorter catechisms. They didn't require tons of it, they required a certain amount of it. When in 1945, I felt that I would like to go to college and study for the ministry, they required the memorization of a ton much more of it, none of which did me any harm, and some of which probably didn't do me any good either, but it's one of those things. In the nature of the confession, they start out with the discussion of what the scripture is, they talk about God, and run through a whole list of things. Almost every doctrine the fathers found some reason to pronounce on in a thing like the Westminster Confession, dating from about 1648. What they were trying to do was to boil down the teaching of the scripture into a confessional form that would identify them and distinguish them from other bodies of Christianity. Now, that does not necessarily mean that they thought they were more right, although most of them did. Most groups that sit down and write a confession inherently feel that they are more right than the other groups. I don't care who they are. They just kind of feel that way inherently, and the feel of the confession will help them to maintain that. But the confession becomes their statement of faith in historic perspective. And a lot of times you will pick up in it things that help give impressions as to what the historic problems were at that particular time. And when the Westminster Confession was originally written, they had no separate article on the Holy Spirit. They just had an article on the Trinity and on the Godhead. And back in the last part of the last century, there was a lot of, there was a big charismatic movement in this country which brought the Southern Presbyterian Church to write a separate section on the Holy Spirit, and after the Westminster Confession was followed by the Southern Presbyterian Church. Shortly after that, there was a big battle over election and predestination and whether you could give invitations and whatnot. So the Southern Presbyterian Church also wrote an article with regard to the way in which the gospel operates and added to the confession. And the Northern Presbyterian Church did neither of those things for reasons of their own. They said originally the confession was long enough, the children could not memorize it anymore as it was, and a bunch of other things. But in each case, the confession is an attempt to state succinctly the exact nature of what you believe. And so the Reformation produced dozens of those symbols. Dozens is an exaggeration. It produced a lot of them. A lot of them. It eventually produced symbols for the Reformed bodies, the Baptist bodies, the Anabaptist bodies. Reformation symbols foiled out for all of them. Independence would soon have a symbol, and that's pretty much the way it would go. Now, I don't think you need to know what all those symbols are for this course. I think you need to know what a symbol is. I think you need to know that the Augsburg symbol is foundational to Lutheranism, and the Westminster Confession is foundational to Reformed theology, especially the Presbyterian variety. Like in many other things, you can never know too much. And in much of life, it's easy to know too little. But I put the names in the notes for point of view of historic reference, as they are the chief Reformation symbols. I wanted to make a note on the stopping if you have any questions there. See, I'm in a big talking mood today. Talking and swallowing. That's the way we Sinaitic people go at it, Sinus Attic people go to it. We talk and swallow. Reminds me of one of my favorite stories, which is a grotesque one, however. I was with a tree surgeon. The tree surgeon used to stop and eat breakfast at a restaurant every morning. Of course, he worked different parts of the world. I'm working different parts of the world, different parts of Pennsylvania. Why, he might not be back in the same community for a year, if you know how it would feel. So we were working in a place called Swickley, and driving over to Swickley every morning, we stopped to eat at a restaurant called Al's Diner, where Al served a lot of potatoes and stuff, and was quite a pleasant fellow, and talked to us by the hour, Al did. Company with him. They served a lot of food. It was a little place. The tree surgeons liked to eat there. They were a rough crew, having just a few people of quality. But they were a rough crew, and we all looked rough with our 16-inch lace boots and our dirty clothes and that sort of thing. But Al would stand there and talk while but Al chewed a wad of tobacco about as large as a baseball. I hardly ever seen it look like he had a cancer of the jaw. It was actually a giant wad of tobacco which represented about half a pound of Union Leader at a time. Good restaurant, though. It's better than snuff. Snuff drips. So Al was chewing that tobacco, that enormous amount of tobacco, day after day after day after day. He was stopping here every morning for breakfast for about 2.5 weeks. He stopped one morning, one of the surgeons said to him after we'd eaten for a while, he said, Al, he says, I've been coming in here for the last couple of weeks. He says, I see you chewing that tobacco, but he said, I never see you relieve yourself of any of the salivary flow that it produces, which in uncultured circles would be known as spitting. Whereupon Al looked him right in the eye and he said, fella, he said, that's what's wrong with most of you guys. He said, that's the best part of this whole business. He said, and they throw it away. The tree surgeons never ate there again. Never ate there again. That's how I feel when the sinus situation is involved. You feel like you've got to carry a giant spittoon along with you. Instead, you just swallow and talk. That keeps things going in a minimum situation. So if you want to say anything, but I want to talk about the progress of dogma. But I can also stop and listen. There's a very subtle squit. No. Not unless I die. Mr. Hughes. That's right. Well, Luther was a big pusher of it. They all pushed it. There wasn't a reformer that didn't push it. But Luther is the father of public education for the masses. There's no question about it. Luther is the father of public education. As long as you were Lutheran, if you were Catholic, they didn't even bother sending you to school. Luther pushed it, and so did Calvin. They all pushed it. Calvin founded a school in Geneva, which a few years after his death enrolled 1,000 students a year. It was kind of a college, kind of an academy type school. So they were all very, very big on that. Yeah, there was a subtle switch with the Reformation. And this, again, is one of those insidious type things, but let me back over it as well as I can. Before the Reformation, you had these, and somewhat during it, to be sure, but before and somewhat during the Reformation, you had this concept of groups meeting and developing a doctrine. They would meet and discuss a key theological issue, make a pronouncement on it, and that would become a touchstone for the church, as I mentioned the other day. But after the Reformation, you have a kind of a switch in that. After the Reformation, you have groups developing, now check this, after the Reformation, you have groups not so much developing doctrines, but you have groups developing after particular doctrines. So that after the Reformation, in the whole concept of after the Reformation, what you get, there's some of it, of course, throughout, and I may be able to sketch it this way, but after the Reformation, what you get is a burst of individual dogmas, or dogmata. You get a burst of dogma. And then you have groups following the particular dogmas. So that you have less and less of a group coming together and establishing a statement of doctrine, and you have more and more of a group following a particular doctrine and identifying itself with that doctrine. That particular doctrine will kind of be pulled out of the file of general belief, whether it's a primary or secondary, 9 times out of 10 are what I would call secondary. It'll be pulled out of the file of general belief, and then the group will follow that.
I've often sketched in a crude sense how the bodies that we call Presbyterian go. Now, Presbyterian is the wrong word. General reform, but how they go. Now, if you let this represent Calvin, and maybe John Knox, I don't know. If you let that represent Calvin, if you see him as kind of the foundational stone in the modern age of those bodies, you'll see a whole segment of Calvin's followers come over into the Netherlands, where they will soon divide into infralapsarians and supralapsarians. They'll soon divide into infralapsarians and supralapsarians. You'll see the same thing true of Calvin's group in France and most places where Calvinists go. They'll soon divide into infralapsarians and supralapsarians, and then you will get a whole church who follows that view or this view. For example, it's overly simplified, but the infralapsarian view in Presbyterian circles was quite generally followed by what we would call the Presbyterian Church in America. Today these fellows are very liberal, but the standard historic Presbyterian Church generally followed the infralapsarian view. Hodge followed it, Warfield followed it. They generally followed the infralapsarian view, and they tended to identify themselves in that particular strain. They followed that doctrine. The Presbyterian Church in North America, which is the Covenanter group that maintains Geneva College and whatnot, followed the supralapsarian doctrine and tended to identify themselves in that camp. They tended to follow it and identify themselves there very heavily. Had a little trouble in France because the Catholics came back and killed about all of them. But they didn't care whether they were infralapsarians or supralapsarians. In this country, Presbyterian majorities came to this country and continued to follow dogmas in the presence of a man like Thomas Campbell, for example, Scots Presbyterian, who was of the supralapsarian school. He was of the Presbyterian Church of North America, supralapsarian school. Came to this country and fell down the hills of western Pennsylvania and began restudying the doctrine of baptism and modified his covenantal relationship to include a necessary baptism by immersion of adults along with a supralapsarian theology to produce what today we would call the Church of Christ. But what I'm saying after the Reformation, without following every particular hitch, is they became followers of doctrine, groups who identified themselves not so much with the totally existing body as with a concept out of that totally existing body. Presbyterians, Baptists, eventually Methodists, and a whole group of others who tended not to identify with the total body, but with some doctrinal concept drawn out of that body. So the doctrine becomes, as far as an overall field is concerned historically, it becomes a very fragmentalized field. And the result is that you have a great unevenness in all of what we would call the secondary doctrines, or that's what I would call them, a great unevenness in the secondary doctrines. But it's on the whole not a recognized unevenness, it's an argued over unevenness. And the result is that you have a great deal of doctrinal superiority, doctrinal inferiority. You have a great deal of that in the ongoing church from the Reformation on. Now, there's hardly a group I know of that I couldn't get long charts on the board. I'm just scribbling here, but long charts indicating how that goes. And not only goes in the major section, often goes in minor sections, Mr. Morris.
Do you think the Reformation leaders recognize that?
No.
Don't think they ever dreamed of it.
I don't think in their wildest moments they foresaw. And I'm not saying necessarily it's bad. That I don't know about, but that's what has happened. So today, you can visit in a community like this a dozen different churches. And the thing that will make them different, well, there are exceptions and there are modernists, but just forget all that for a moment. The thing that will make them different, invariably, is their key insistence on following some particular doctrine, which, if you lay out all the doctrines, is invariably secondary. But in their mind eye, historically, it becomes more important than the major doctrine. Almost always happens that way. Now, when liberals come in, all doctrines kind of die. Liberalism has not done the church any good. It makes it more broad-minded. We used to say a broad mind, it's like an open window without a screen in it. The mosquitoes come through, the bugs come through, all kinds of things. So liberalism, on the whole, kills everything. In time, it kills itself. It is self-destructing, this idea that nothing really counts and they're all relatives. In time, it is self-destructing. But while it's in the process of self-destructing, it causes a lot of grief to others who don't want to be self-destructive. Mr. Grossman.
Well, I think that's a good point.
Do you think that's a reaction of sorts against, you know, the, apparently the 15 churches in town that used to all argue about secondary things? Do you think modernism is really partly a reaction against that?
I suppose that in its earliest stages it does that. I suppose in its earliest stages it does that, probably. I suppose. It's hard to know. And there are actually, I don't know how many churches there are in Happyfield. There are about 5 or 6. I just grabbed a quick number, see, but wouldn't make a lot of difference. Most of the bodies are in Happyfield. I could give you a pretty quick running history on the body, not the local church, but on the body. And in the case of all of them, you will quickly see, you may not agree with my analysis in every point, but you'll quickly see that's exactly how it goes. They become the followers of a particular doctrine. And maybe the modernists come about because they react to that much intensified study in this foundational stage, I might say, or the arguing. I personally hate arguments. I was raised in a house where there was fighting almost continually, and I hate it, see. So if there's an argument, I'm prone to go and hide in my cellar. Good thing to pay the church isn't left up to me, Mr. Christian.
So as you get further away from your source, each body identifies itself with more and more through your doctrines.
Rather than the total organism, that's right. That's right. Which produces in time a very fragmented church. So you go to a church. You go to a church for fellowship. You won't be offended if I use a crude example. It's easy to say things, but you go to a church for fellowship. And the fellow says, we're glad to have you come. We'd kind of like to know what you believe.
You can read him the Nicene Creed, read him the Constantinople Creed, read him the Chalcedonian Creed, and he'll say, well, that's nice. But now, he's certainly asked you what you believe about baptism. He's certainly asked you what you believe about other things. He's very likely to ask you what you believe about the Holy Spirit in greater detail. He's very likely to ask you what you believe about
the millennium, or the tribulation, or 1,001 other things, or the Textus Receptus. He's about, in 9 places out of 10, they will go through a whole gamut of things like that, and you'll say to yourself, am I identified with the church or with a core of particular points of belief? And in the practical realm today, the identification is with a core of particular points of belief. I'm not happy with that, incidentally. But I don't know what the easy answer to it is. You can't go back to the apostolic age. History never goes backward. People sometimes go backward. We call it senility. But time doesn't go backward, and we don't go backward either. Well, historical theology doesn't cure your problem. It just simply shows you how it develops.
And it also indicates, too, that it will probably get worse as time goes on. Until the Lord ends these things, or until they come to a consummation, it will probably get worse.
I personally always try to avoid, I like to avoid disputes and arguments. I'm happy to be part of a fellowship where they don't ask you too many questions about too many things. They'd like to know some things of you, of course, but they don't ask you too many questions about too many things. As long, basically, as you don't become overly troublesome. So you run into a great, great freedom of opinion. I went to a conference, sat in a panel with 2 guys. One of those fellows was about as Arminian as you could be. And I'm quite heavy in the other direction. But I think we were both pleasant, so we had a nice time. Folks say, well, how can you do it? The way you can do it, I think, is by recognizing that we are not followers of a doctrine, but followers of a church. And the church is the living body. But it's still a lot of complications in there that you will have to resolve for yourself as time and whatnot goes on. A friend of mine went to candidate at a church one time, and he made a mistake of giving a gesture in his sermon. They saw he had a wedding ring on. They had a no jewelry clause in their constitution, and consequently, they asked him if he was willing to forego the wearing of rings and other worldly baubles. pretty good-sized church. None of them wore rings, but he felt that he perhaps was not quite ready to go to that state yet, or maybe he felt his wife wasn't ready to go to that state yet. But see, that's the following of a doctrine. Now, I can look over and say, well, that's a polity matter, they ought to be prudent, but most people who are caught in a thing don't think of it that way. Now, as far as historical theology is concerned, this situation in the last couple of years is rather new. I shouldn't say the last couple of years, the last three centuries is rather new. Because even among the fathers, you have men who emphasize one thing and men who emphasize another thing, but their standard thought is for the body. Of course, the ecumenical movement threatens to try and get back to that, but they've given up faith in the Lord. Giving up faith in the Lord, you can't go to something that you don't have.
I'm not trying to put it back together, but here's what I'd like to have. I'd like to have a situation, if I, you know, if you have made the magic wand, I'd like to have a situation like existed roughly before Nicaea, in which there was no organizational unity for the whole, but a great feeling of oneness, with each group kind of, to use a classic Koine expression, each local area running its own show, so that in Rome, they took back the Trabecors very easily, and in Carthage, you had to crawl on your hands and knees to get there. But each group kind of running its own show, but yet feeling the essential oneness of the body. If I can reach a magic wand, that's what I can do. We will not come back. Do you see the difference in that? I'm the last fellow in the world who wanted organizational unity. They are always bad. But the sense of oneness is what we would like to see in the church if we had the ability to see it. Now, we may feel that personally, say, and we should, I think. I used to say when I was in the service, you jumped in the foxhole, another fellow jumped in, he's carrying a New Testament, and you didn't ask him what church he went to. Even if he was a Mormon, if he could shoot well, you didn't ask him any questions. Just hope he knew how to point to things.
In some circles, wouldn't you say that fear
of fellowship with bodies that differ in my seminary doctrine, because if you did fellowship with people who differ from you, you might actually be tempted to be more competitive. Yes. Yes. And there's some legitimacy to it, too. Any kind of fellowship requires the maximum cooperation of both parties. The maximum cooperation of both parties. There's some fear of it. And I really should leave these things for Grawley's courses, I suppose. It's just that I'm kind of fascinated by the historical processes and fascinated by the historical statements of our particular day and age. I see the historic backgrounds that give rise to them. And I can't really criticize or fault those historic backgrounds. But I do know that they don't help us a whole lot. When another fellow is caught in the thresh of a problem, we look over and say, well, I thought he had a cross in his church. I don't, you know, if he's got a cross in the church, let that help him. And we quickly get into that kind of a thinking situation.
Well, all we do in historical theology is try to show how we get to a particular point. We don't cure it. I can't help but philosophize a bit because that's my essential nature. But that's how we get there. And that's what we mean by the progress of dogma in the post-Reformation age. The group no longer is as much involved in defining dogmas as it is in following doctrines. And sometimes the doctrines are rather important, but the primary level doctrines are almost universally agreed on by all Christians. The vicarious atonement, etc. They're almost all universally, they are not the things that tend to make us distinct. The things that makes us distinct, 9 times out of 10, are the secondary dogmas that we follow, 9 times out of 10. In a church where I was saved at that time, they sang only the Psalms. They changed that. But they sang the Psalms. And I love to sing the Psalms. I wish that's all we sung. I get so tired of these rocky little choruses, you hardly believe it. I go to a lot of youth camps. They like to sing these rocky choruses. Jump on a rock and praise the Lord. Talk about an allegory, Dr. Wasser. In my own mind, they are an abomination to me. But I go to the camps and sing them with the gang and say nothing about them. Well, I might say one. I don't think I say anything about it. I try not to. Yeah, it's not my business, really. I'm supposed to be doing something else, so I attempt not to be a big critic of everybody's music. In my own mind, amplifiers for guitars should all be put in the pit.
I love the guitar. I think it's a great instrument to sing with and whatnot, but these high body amplifiers that make the guitar sound like a chord organ poorly played, I would like to see them all. But that's a personal thing. But you'll discover after a while that those are the kind of dogmas that become identification to us. We had an edict at our church for a long time that nobody could accompany themselves with a guitar. I think we've gotten over that. But that was because of a couple of rocky types that came through from a famous Bible school who shook the brethren with loud vibes and left them limp when the horns and they concluded that it wasn't the groove, it was the guitar. That's what it was. I said, man, oh man, I used to play a guitar myself. But poorly, poorly. But I know, maybe I'm jealous because I didn't have a big amplifier. They shook us so that it took 10 years to get over it. And we may not be over it yet, but I think maybe we are. And suddenly we become identified as the no guitar church. And this group becomes identified as the no kitchen church. And but that's what we mean by the following of doctrine. And in historical theology, that's the big switch that comes with the Reformation Age. The big switch. And the following of dogma leads to the development of increasing numbers of new churches. I was talking to Mr. Scott in the dining hall the other night. There are a couple of guys at that table. And you were there. Where's Newby? Yeah, you were there. I think he was there. I think they were there because I stayed here. Aiden was going to be something else. And he told us that he fears that there may well be a kind of a doctrinal division in the GARBC. I'll have to talk to Scott if you want to talk about that further. I don't really know. But the history, see, of the church has been the following of a doctrine. And then 9 times out of 10 are not the primary doctrines. Primary doctrines are those we think are necessary, essential for life and salvation. 9 times out of 10, they are not those. Although, of course, if it's one that I like, then it's mighty important. Mr. Thompson.
What is GARBC?
The General Association of Regular Baptist Churches.
Yeah,
it's one of the few I know. I also know Federal Employment's Income Tax. FICO. And a couple other things like that, yeah. Any thoughts on that subject before I stop?
Another subject, maybe? Sort of that subject.
Yeah, I'm leaving that subject.
Well, I think that we're following that suite of theology sort of in a channel down to where biblical theology is, and everything that branches off at some point. We forget about it, that's right. For this course,
That's right. Because we don't have either time or the expertise to develop it. Hard to know which we like the most there. But that's right. Yes, I'm about to leave that. That's for sure.
Well, what would you define as primary doctrines?
Well, primary doctrines are those that are essential for salvation and life. And we'd say that the essential ones are on the Trinity, on the person of Christ, on the nature of his sacrifice. And I would add to that the character of Scripture. I would say that ultimately the character of Scripture is foundational to all others. I would say, however, that you might meet somebody who does not have a correct view of the Scripture, and you might get somebody whose view has been tortured on the person of Christ. But I would say that when you move beyond those, you are out of the primary doctrine.
Isn't even that, though, sort of up to the individual's interpretation of what the primary doctrine is?
Yes.
Maybe somebody who knows that it would play the part.
Yes, but there you're outside the pale of the mass of Christianity. I'm defining primary doctrine and what the mass of Christianity has accepted over the last 1900 years, or about that. And in that area, all these minor points become less meaningful in that area. There are other things, in other words, a particular issue may be hot. Like 20 years ago, television was a hot issue. Not 20 years ago, 25 years ago, television was a hot issue. Today, the people who 25 years ago were the most anti-television, today most of those guys have done their studies and they watch the Super Bowl without the deacon going. So those particular things come and go.
Well, is it conceivable then that 150 years hence, you know, something like well, for example, playing guitar could become a primary doctrine?
No. The tertiary and secondary doctrines never seem to become primary. They seem to become minimal. But the problem with theology is that people don't tend to make primary. The problem with theology is that people tend to water down primaries to be meaningless. And the others just kind of, they constantly replace themselves. Dr. Gosner?
I don't know, maybe I'm stepping out of a limb, but I would almost claim that even to take something like the Constantinople Creed, you've got to do a little bit of footwork of interpreting what they mean, like, for example, baptism for the remission of sins, and things like that.
I'm sure that meant a very different thing to different people.
You certainly have to look and to understand. Of course, that they take directly from Peter's citation. So there your question is one of interpreting the scripture and interpreting the creed too. They really make that almost a verbatim quote from Acts. And so your problem is one of biblical interpretation. And of course, that's certainly, there's no question there. Everything written or in literary form has to be understood schematically by the hearer. And so there's a certain amount of interpretation. If a mother says to a boy, go to the store and buy a loaf of bread, there's a certain amount of interpretation, and you're certainly right there.
Oh, you had a statement and a creed about hating your mother.
Yes.
Or something like that. You'd say, well, they must put special significance of that. You know, and the same with that for Christian sins. There must be something special to me.
Yes. Yes. You're certainly right. It becomes a matter of understanding what they meant where you can, and pushing forth. But a lot of times, in understanding what they meant is not only the history, but understanding the scriptures behind which they said it. As the earlier creeds are written as sentences, they make as much of biblical language as they can, and then amplify on that. Yeah, Mr. Wise?
I had a question for a while in my mind as we were studying this. We talked a lot about the means of salvation through Christ's death, Christ, and the person of Christ who is the maker. But I was just wondering where some of the ideas about the method of salvation, if we ask Muslims in Israel, how we think Christ is, we think of the time we say we receive Christ or ask Christ to help us, or something like that. With this idea, perspective, I haven't seen anything about Christ being in the church fathers and the fathers of Christ and anything like that, but if we would have.
I think you'll find a good deal of it in their writings. I mentioned in my notes in the Reformation the views of both Calvin and Luther as to how conversion comes to us. Each age has to adopt its own language to describe its own experience. And even in our country, the description of experience of conversion in Whitfield's day is drastically different than in our day, just the description of it. So I've usually looked beyond the description to see what the writings were and what reality they indicated, and find a great commonality in them. But in Whitfield's Great Revivals, Whitfield gave virtually no invitations. He preached up, you know what I mean by an invitation. But man, he preached to knock them down, drag them out, think of other people lying on the ground crying for their sins, and Whitfield went around and see what was wrong. things of that sort. So methods change to meet a circumstance, to meet an occasion. And the arrangement of ideas change to meet that too. I haven't done anything with that.
The group? Then the idea of Christ in you is one of those things that sort of given all along.
Yes, that's right. It's one of those things which people said, well, we all understand it. And things which we all understand, we never say much about. That's kind of par for the course. Yeah. That's what you hope when you look at a congregation and say, you understand what I'm saying, don't you? You hope, yeah. But actually, maybe you don't know, and maybe they don't know either. So as long as there's agreement, you can be happy. That's really pretty vague. Well, let us take a break. I will not say any more about the progress of dogma. I will say about two words about Roman reactions, and then we will move to the modern period. It's about 10 after 9.